AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone, passion for excellence.
This is AutoLine After Hours with John McElroy, episode 71 for September 16th, 2010. EIEIOESA. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLineDetroit.tv every Thursday at 7 p.m. Eastern Time or 2300 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine After Hours in the iTunes Store. And joining me, as always, as I described him this morning in the promo we did for the show, that auto-bodacious, auto-extremist Peter DeLorenzo.
John, good to be back.
That's great to have you here, Peter. We've had a week off, and, man, I can't wait to get back into it. Also joining us, Mark Phelan from the Detroit Free Press. Mark, great having you back here.
Thank you very much, John.
And even though Neil DeCoker, the CEO of the Original Equipment Suppliers Association, has been on AutoLine Detroit before, never on AutoLine After Hours. And it's great having you here, too, Neil.
Great to be here. It's a very exciting evening for me.
Well, you know, we're going to talk about some of the news, and then we definitely want to talk about the supplier side of things. But I think some of the big news this week was Chrysler presenting its new model lineup to its dealers. And it was only the dealers. They let out little dribs and drabs that we in the media, you know, glommed onto. But we really don't know a whole lot about it. Mark, I don't know if you got a chance to report on any of this or what you think.
I don't know much more, you know, probably than you. But, I mean, the headline out of it is that the reworked Sebring that's coming later this year, they're going to ditch the Sebring name and call it the 200. And my understanding is that it's an almost all new interior, but that exterior changes are pretty much limited to, you know, front clip, grill, and, you know, rear bumper.
Yeah, and they showed it, and as soon as I saw the roof line was
the C-pillar.
The C-pillar is just like,
it's because to go in and change hard points, you start talking real money.
Of course, true to form, Sergio, the hype king now, PT Sergio. He said it was the most extensive new car, you know, transformation in the industry. And it's just like, come on, really?
Changing any of the actual engineering, perhaps.
Yeah, we got Ford over there. We got GM over here. We got the Hyundai Kia juggernaut. We've got Nissan, Renault. We got Volkswagen and he's got the most extensive.
Remember, he's got a pump, and here Ben's got.
Well, I know it's a dealer meeting where you do that, but even he crossed the line with this one. I mean, come on.
The one thing that I thought was interesting is they did put out a video clip of Mike Maroon, who's the chief operating officer of AutoNation. And, you know, we've had Mike Jackson, the CEO of AutoNation, here before, and we've asked him, you know, do you have any big three stores? Barely any. You know, they really don't like big three stores. They especially did not like Chrysler stores. And here's this clip of Mike Maroon from AutoNation literally gushing about the lineup that he saw there. So I don't know if he's vying for a Fiat Alfa Romeo outlet, and that's why he's talking nice, but I thought it was significant that AutoNation would say such nice things about Chrysler's upcoming lineup.
And the fact that some of the dealers who were there are saying that they were shown a mock-up of a Jeep pickup is very interesting, too, I think, because, I mean, Jeep has tried that before and had
and varying failed miserably.
I was going to say varying levels of success, but it does seem to be one of the places that wouldn't be much of a stretch for the Jeep lineup to go if there's a market for it.
There's not a stretch, but they tried it before, and the reason it didn't work is that you have this brand that used to be called Dodge, now called Ram, that's in the same business. So why are you competing against yourself? I don't know. I don't get that part of it. Another guy that we saw come through town this week was the new head of Volkswagen of America, Jonathan Browning. And I think you got a chance to meet with him, Mark,
yes,
did you?
Yes, I did. Yes, he was in town to meet some of the folks at Volkswagen's offices up in Auburn Hills, and he, you know, made some time to talk to the press as well. He's I would think that he's in the hot seat as much as anybody in the business. I mean, he's got a billion-dollar plant that's about to open to build a new, completely untested car. And that untested car is the cornerstone of their plan to quadruple American sales. And if they can't hit 800,000 units a year in America, which is what the VW brand wants to do, the whole corporate goal of upsetting Toyota as the world's largest car company goes down the drain. So, I mean, Jonathan Browning is, you know...
Is he British?
Yes, he is. Yeah, he is.
With no experience in the American market, right?
He has lived in America a couple of times. He worked for about 25 years for GM and Ford. And he lived in America for a total of about 4 years. And during that time, he was doing some, not consecutively, 2 years in the 80s, 2 years in the aughts. And he was doing some work that had some American connection. But he's never been in charge of sales for anybody in America. So it's new business for him.
Neil, do you know anything about this guy? And is Volkswagen talking to suppliers, and what with this manufacturing plant getting going now?
We had a town hall meeting last week with Volkswagen on September 9th, about 300 suppliers in the audience. And it was a two-hour session, and Tom Luffman, who is the director of purchasing, did an outstanding job of bringing us up to date on what the plant looked like, what the status was, and so forth. And they talked quite a bit about it. It was excellent.
And one of the things that, you know, Browning was saying was that local sourcing was, he thought, one of the two big things that they needed to do to get to that, you know, audacious target. I mean, they have to fix, you know, quality, of course. They have to get the dealers up to speed, improving customer service, you know, and a number of other things. But sourcing, you know, was a really big deal for him because he just wants to be as isolated as he can from currency fluctuations.
Well, they also recognized when they looked at their global sourcing activity that they greatly underutilized North America. That North America represented like 4% of the total sourcing for VW in the world, and yet North America is a much larger market, much more significant. So they're making a conscientious effort to increase their sourcing. They have a show in Wolfsburg October 5th. It'll be focused on Canada and the United States. They've got 150 suppliers that have been invited to exhibit, so that several thousand of Volkswagen engineers have an opportunity to get exposure to these suppliers and their capabilities. So I think it's a sincere effort.
Well, I'm sure if, you know, they're ramping up production in the U.S. that much, and with the way the dollar has performed overall against the euro, it's got to look pretty attractive to source a lot more in North America.
I would think so, absolutely.
Well, I wrote about it. There's not a snowball's chance in hell they're going to sell 800,000.
I was just going to ask you, Peter, what you thought the possibility was.
Now, you know, let's review. First of all, they're dumbing down the Jetta.
Right.
You know, they made it bigger, but they also decontented it so that they could slot it under the car that's coming from
Chattanooga. And it's a nice car, but it isn't as nice as the older Jettas were.
No. And, you know, you're playing with fire once you start doing that.
And especially when you start saying we're going to triple, or you said quadruple sales?
They were just over 200,000 last year.
And they want to get to 800,000.
The goal is 800,000.
And that's what, in the next 8 years?
Yep, 2018.
Yowza.
Yeah. Yeah. Plus, I mean, you know, the Jetta, you know, they've taken a lot of content out. And that suggests that the way they think they appeal to American buyers is make the car bigger and put less stuff in it. And that raises the question, is that what they're going to do with the midsize sedan coming out of the new plant in Chattanooga? And if they have, I would think there's a chance that they're going to have, you know, a billion-dollar white elephant sitting on their hands.
Well, I mean, you know, people, enthusiasts gravitated to Volkswagen because, you know, if they couldn't get a BMW or something like that, it was still the European driving experience. And, you know, they basically hit on that. They had many misses over the years, but basically they delivered that. And now they're consciously walking away from that to broaden their reach into this market. And I think, you know, you're playing with fire when you do that. I mean, putting standard rear drum brakes on the Jetta to make it the loss leader price-wise. And this engineer wrote me and lectured me about, oh, there's nothing wrong with drum brakes. No, there isn't anything wrong with drum brakes. However, in this day and age, it's like going back to rope steering. You know, I mean, it just doesn't sound good.
Right.
I mean,
the market,
you know,
expects more.
Yeah. And so, you know, they're going to lose their soul. They're going to lose their way. And could be a white elephant. You know, that plant's going to have to, they're not only going to have to build 350,000 units in that plant, they're going to have to sell them every year.
And if they're going to do that, at some point in the near future, they've got to take the plunge and have extensive powertrain manufacturing here. And then you're talking about another $1 billion or so. So, I mean, it gets to be a real high-risk operation.
Well, would they do that because they have powertrain in Mexico? You know, I think they would just
either build here or invest significantly, you know, in different lines and you know, different engines as well down there.
Well, you know,
but yeah, they might be able to do it in Mexico, but wherever they do it, they will be spending money on.
You know, a billion here, a billion there, starts adding up after a while. You know.
Well, they've got tremendous engine capacity in other parts of the world, though, so they could say, okay, we're going to need 50 or 100,000 1.6-liter diesels from here. We're going to need 80,000 of these four cylinders from someplace else. And I think they've got a lot of capacity that they don't need to add powertrain for a while.
But if they aim at the Camry with an Americanized Volkswagen, there's no reason for being for Volkswagen. I mean, then whatever.
It will no longer have the appeal that VW's had.
Yeah.
That's why the new Jetta is such a key vehicle to watch, I think. I mean, will it appeal to new buyers? And what will existing Volkswagen owners think of it? Because I think there's, I was driving one just recently, and there's nothing wrong with it, but there's nothing that seems like it's going to pull a person out of a Civic, and there's nothing that says to me it has the same personality as a Jetta, so who is going to buy it?
Yeah. Well, Dan Neal wrote a brilliant
critique
of the Jetta in last Saturday's Journal that was priceless, but you know, he ticked off all the things that were just so un-Volkswagen-like and just clearly downgraded that, you know, I don't know. I think it's the wrong way to go.
Mm-hmm.
And they want to be a volume brand here, but they don't understand what American buyers want. And they don't seem to understand that their existing loyal buyers don't want the same stuff that the vast majority of
Well, the existing loyal buyers will be turned off completely.
That's the risk.
Yeah, I find it very curious to bring in a guy. Okay, you say he's lived here 4 years. I don't think he's got a good base of experience in this market. And I got to believe, okay, they've got a plant and all, but this guy's coming in for mainly sales and marketing. So,
in fact, I asked him about that. The plant theoretically reports to him, but all of their work is done through VW's global manufacturing. So he's sales and marketing, dealer relations, nothing else.
Right. So I wish them luck, but it's that's an awfully aggressive sales target.
Well, we'll know they're officially in trouble if he starts wearing an 800,000 lapel pin.
I'll tell you one thing that speaks well of his being a sort of a reality-based person. We asked him about the Phaeton, because there's a new generation of the Phaeton coming, and he said, well, you know, the Phaeton plays an important role in Volkswagen's global product strategy, but I don't know that there's any need for it in the United States.
He said that?
Yes, he did.
Yow.
That's a paraphrase, but that's the
Wow.
That's a last executive that said that. Piak had him taken out back and shot.
That's exactly right. Hey, another change that we saw announced in the last week, Mark Hogan, ex-GM executive, been hired by Toyota as an advisor. Did anybody know any more than that?
Just, you know, they figured they need all the help they can get. I thought that was very interesting, though.
Neil, you must know Mark.
I know Mark very well, and he worked with Akio Toyota back in the NUMMI days, so they know each other.
Oh, good point. I forgot.
They've known each other.
He's a NUMMI grad,
because
he was the graduating class, so to speak.
Yeah.
He was one of the first ones to go over to NUMMI.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think there's a long relationship and mutual respect there, and this is an opportunity to just get some more help.
Yeah.
And I think Mark was dying to get back into the real business.
Oh, I'm sure he is. I've got a lot of respect for Mark. You know, he did a bang-up job for a GM in Brazil.
Yeah, he sure did.
And then he ran into that buzzsaw called the UAW. And because, remember, GM tasked him with the job of figuring out how to build small cars profitably in the United States. They were going to do the plant up in Lansing, right?
Right.
And he wanted to have suppliers involved.
Using modular systems.
Right. Yeah. And yeah. Steve Jokic hit the roof when he heard this. Yeah. And I thought it was shameful how GM treated him, actually, that they cowered behind the UAW and let Steve Jokic call for his head, and that's what happened.
The UAW was very powerful back in those days, and management did not know how to handle it, as you could tell with all three of the domestic vehicle manufacturers. You know, over a period of 25, 30 years, it just more and more power.
Yeah.
It's very tough.
It was particularly craven of GM management, though, because, I mean, Mark Hogan didn't say, we're going to build a plant that takes modules in and builds them less expensively on his own. I mean, everybody above him in the corporation knew that was the plan. And when he went
sure,
out,
what they said is, they disavowed, look at this great job you did in Brazil. Yeah. Come over here and replicate it.
Yeah.
Here's your job. Go build small cars profitably in America. And when he tries to go do that and the union objects, they cut his head off. It was shameful of GM management.
Yeah.
But, well, I'm sure we'll hear more about him. And then Dan Akerson had a press conference today where he was talking to the media. And
he's got his mission. We're going on the offensive.
Attack mode.
Attack mode. I want everyone reporting at 0600.
I'm not sure we learned anything from this press conference today, except just a chance to get to see this guy and hear what he's like and that sort of thing. But I'm not sure any news came.
No, that's exactly why they did it.
Yeah, statement of no plan changes in management. I would hope not. There have been so many. You would think that by now they have the core team in place, and any more changes would really, really disrupt the ability of the team to really get the job done.
But it's interesting. Yeah. I was not able to attend the press conference. I did listen to the audio tape they made available. When he was asked about that, are you going to have any more changes, there was, now I'm not going to say a long pause, but there was a pause before he answered. In fact, I thought he chose his words very carefully in most of the tough questions. And so he thought about it. He didn't come out and say, no, we've got everybody we need. It was like, pause, let me think this through. No. So I think there's more changes coming. That's how I read that kind of pause.
Now, there's some people left at Hyundai that they haven't hired yet.
What do you guys make of all these battery plants there? You know, we've seen so much in the news. And in the last week, we had here locally, A123 Systems had their big opening. It seems every time you pick up the paper these days, somebody's got a new battery plant.
Well, I think you were right, John. I think you were the one that nailed it, said, you know, there's going to be kind of a battery plant bubble going on.
Yeah, kind of like new assembly plants in China. You know, it's just
there's too much going in there, yeah.
That's a lot going in there. But the government had a lot to do with that. They made billions of dollars available for this, and that certainly influences how much of this you're going to see.
Well, how do you guys view it from the supplier side, Neil? Because it's all your members who are making these plants.
Yeah, or new members. You know, the owners of A123 are now the traditional supplier industry.
Right, but I mean, JCI, for example, Dow, who else am I missing there? Is LG Chem or?
LG Chem, yeah.
Are they a member of yours?
They're not. They're not. But they should be.
They should be. Absolutely should be.
Yeah. Yeah, it's just an exciting period. There's just an awful lot of good things going on. And we see with the new technologies coming out, with the plug-in hybrids, the hybrids, the pure electrics.
But what do your members talk about? Because all of this is predicated on massive subsidies. As I like to point out, subsidies to build the battery plants, subsidies to build the assembly plants to make electric cars, subsidies for the chargers to put in your garage to charge them, and subsidies to go out and buy the stupid cars in the first place. And I say, I give these subsidies 3 years. 3 years, and then all the governments are going to go, we're broke. There's no more money. And then, you know, that Leaf, Nissan Leaf, is no longer $20,000 in California. It's now $35,000. And the battery charger in your garage is no longer free. It's $2,000 to wire it in. And what do your members think in terms of, because, and not just the batteries now, electric motors, power electronics, all the other things that go into EVs, they've got to be really wary about how much they invest in going into this business.
I would think they are. I mean, there are certain suppliers that are very, very strongly heading into this area. There's others that have gone in and have been cut off a little bit because an OEM announces we're going to make our own electric motors after significant effort by one of their suppliers to get in, or two or three suppliers to get into that area. So, yeah, we see it as a period of we've got to be very, very careful. But the thing that amazes me is if our government would put a fuel tax on where all citizens who buy cars and operate them make a judgment about what kind of a vehicle they want based on the impact on their pocketbooks, and the, including the operating costs, we wouldn't have to have all
I know, but I've been writing that for decades now, and the American public just goes berserk when you talk about a gas tax.
I think politicians run for cover. They go berserk. Americans understand it. That's my belief.
I don't think Americans understand it. I really don't. I think because everybody's in such dire economic straits right now, and the gas bill, filling up your tank, is something you do every single week. And when it costs $15 to $20 to fill a tank, not that big of a deal. But when it starts costing $40 to $50 a week to fill a tank, people feel that, and they feel it instantly. And they don't want that going up at all.
Yeah, it'd be political suicide for a lot of people, but that raises the basic question of do they get elected to do stuff or to get reelected?
They've got to be responsible. Look at what all the other developed economies are doing. You know, $7 a gallon is very, very common.
The norm in Europe.
It's the norm in Europe. It's the norm in Japan. And we have a national energy policy based on cheap fuel. What that means is we're dependent on imports. We're not doing nuclear. You know, when I started advocating this in 1976, France was generated 20% of their electricity with nuclear power, and so did we. Today, we generate 20% of our electricity with nuclear power, and France is at 80%. Now, talk about carbon footprint and having to clean up and do all that kind of stuff, the environment. Who's way ahead? And in Europe, the average fuel economy for vehicles is 34, 35 miles per gallon. Why? Not because people can't afford bigger cars and so forth. It doesn't make any sense. At $7 a gallon, you're going to get Mercedes and BMWs. You're going to get smaller vehicles with lots of technology on them because people can afford the higher price of the vehicle in many cases. But from an operating standpoint, it makes no sense at $7 a gallon to drive a Grand Cherokee with a 5.7-liter engine. It just doesn't make any sense.
Right.
We need to somehow.
Well, I've put out two ideas. Number one is I think we should establish a goal that within the decade we're going to get off OPEC oil. OPEC, you know, we're not going to get off oil in that time, but we can get off OPEC oil, I believe, within a decade. And the other thing that I think has got to be, we've got to establish a clear connection between having the Fifth Fleet in the Gulf, you know, the Seventh Fleet in the Straits of Malacca. Our guys and gals, our war fighters going face down to keep these oil lines open. And when people start objecting to, I'm not going to pay more in gas taxes, and it's like, well, listen, we're not going to send our war fighters overseas to die just so that you don't have to pay that much to fill up your tank. That kind of argument, I think Americans would buy into.
And I think you're onto that. And Americans, you talk about we should use less fuel, it'll be good for the country, good for the environment, and the only people who listen to that are the people who already believed it. Okay. But when you start making it a national security issue, that reaches people in a different way and it reaches more people.
Well, yeah, we don't have an energy policy, basically, right, in this country. Right. And we found out 2 years ago that all those years of CAFE and all that other crap didn't really
Didn't do anything.
Was a waste of
Our
time.
Our oil consumption went up.
Yeah, because 2 years ago, everyone started getting it realistically, hit them in the head. Oh, $4 a gallon? And not so much. I might choose differently. You know, and we talked about a sliding scale with taxes built in. You know, this year it's going to be $3.50. In, 18 months it's going to be $4.50. In 28 months, it's going to be $5.50, and then we're going to keep it there. It won't go below that. So everyone can start figuring out now what they want to drive. What is it worth it? You know, what's it worth to you?
Right.
How much you want to spend every week to put?
And then you can say, okay, if you're at X income level, you know, and if you're below that, you get a quarterly check from the government, kickback, you know, so you help poor people or people who are really straining just to try to get to work to have a job, you help them out on it.
And it's a heck of a lot cheaper than a $7,500 incentive to buy a hybrid vehicle or stuff like that.
An electric, right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
Yeah, you could do away with all that. You could do away with CAFE. You could do away with everything. You just have this. It's $5 a gallon minimum. So
it would solve everything. You know, and Europe now has a CO2 standard. Right. But prior to that, there was never any CAFE. There was no fuel economy regulation. To your point, Neil, they didn't need it.
No. You're going to drive more fuel-efficient vehicles when it's $7 a gallon if you can't afford.
That's right.
And you have to drive.
And you're not just going to sit by the curbside with the engine idling either. You're going to turn it off when you come to a stop.
And we're also going to put in more of an infrastructure for mass transit in areas where it's justified.
Sure. In high population density areas, that makes all the sense in the world.
And we don't have that in this country.
No, we don't. Hey, let's talk more about your side of the business, though, Neil. What do you see going on, especially in the U.S. market right now? Everyone thought that sales were really going to make more of a comeback. And, you know, at the beginning of the year, there was a whole bunch of sales projections that this year we would hit 12 million, 12.5 million vehicles. Some were even saying 12.7, 12.8. Now everybody slid that way on, definitely under 12. We just had Jeremy Anwill in here from Edmunds.com. He's saying 11.3 million. What do you see going on out there?
Well, certainly the volumes have been better than we expected in the first half of the year, and we kept waiting for the shoe to drop, saying, well, I wonder what next quarter will bring. It is bringing a little bit lower volume, but what we've seen is that we've held a line on hiring. We've held a line on overhead. We haven't been able to get money from the banks too readily, so that makes it easier to not expand too quickly because you don't get the money anyway. But we've really focused on keeping costs under control. Those companies that survived 2009 at 8.6 million vehicle North American production are very lean, and we're to this year at about 11.6 million North American vehicle production. That's 3 million more, and those that survived last year this year are making money, just like Ford, GM. The same thing is happening with suppliers. And I have not talked to a member that's complaining about financial survival and so forth. We've had, I think, one or two Chapter 11 bankruptcies this year. We had 56 last year.
Wow.
We had another 200 suppliers that liquidated or disappeared, left the business. And those are even hard to measure. It's an estimated number.
But isn't there a lot of acquisitions and going on, mergers and the like? So even though they may not be going out of business, entire companies are disappearing.
Yeah. And this year we're starting to see a lot of M&A activity. The mergers and acquisition bubble is going to start happening. The private equity firms are starting to see that, again, there's real money to be made in the industry, although albeit they're being very careful. They're still looking at companies that are solid, and there's only a few private equity people that focus on weak companies that they can turn around. That was some focus on that, but the vast majority are looking for the stronger ones.
I'm seeing, because I'm starting to pay more attention to production now than sales, because that tells you what's coming. And we saw a big drop-off in production in July, which historically happens, although GM kept running all through July, and even it saw its production go down. We saw a bump up in August, and now, based on what I'm looking at into the production numbers, we're down significantly from August.
Yeah, and I haven't seen those numbers, but it moves around from month to month. We hope to see a little bit more stability, but what we are recognizing finally is that we don't have a push system anymore. We're not going to keep those factories running at all costs and let day supplies go wherever they go and then provide consumer incentives to get the stuff off the lots. What we're doing is saying if the dealers want vehicles, we'll build them. If they don't want them, we don't build them. And the control on day supplies is keeping costs in the industry under control. And it's a big help. And that's why you're seeing more profitability in companies like General Motors and Ford. And you see it also in suppliers. But we have to be more flexible in terms of being able to shut down our production when the demand isn't there. So having the workforce, for example, as a real variable cost as opposed to fixed costs as we had with contracts that said, if you don't work, you get 95% of your pay anyway, so don't worry about it. I mean, those kind of things had to change in order to get our industry back on track.
I'm not sure if people outside the industry are aware of what I would call a miraculous transformation in the Detroit-based car industry in the last 12 months. Now, to your point, Ford is amazingly profitable right now, given the conditions. GM looks rock solid. Chrysler claims it's at an operating profit, and these are at abysmally low sales levels. You're talking about your members, the suppliers, all generally doing reasonably well right now, and again, at abysmally low sales levels. And I'm not sure that the rest of the country has caught on to the fact that what a dramatic transformation has taken place.
Yeah, it is. It's something that we can be very proud of in one sense, that we were able to do it. It's still sad that it took a couple hundred thousand jobs lost and a lot of shutting down of factories that affected towns, complete towns. And that is, unfortunately, what had to happen. But it's the final result is that we have a much stronger industry that I think will be much more competitive with global competitors going forward.
You mentioned all the factories going into China. I'm sure all your members are over there, too. What do you see of the Chinese market? Because we keep hearing things that there's warnings that there's overcapacity problems looming in China. Others who are saying, no, there's far more growth left in this thing. How do you read it?
We see tremendous growth still for a significant number of years in the future. There's such underlying demand there when you look at 1.3 billion people, and they're dying to be part of the success. They're coming out of the country and coming into the cities and just dying to be a part of the success of the economy, something that they've waited for 50 years to be a part of, like the rest of the world. So we see continued growth for a significant number of years to come. And the number of companies that we have going into China continues to grow. Most of the purpose for being there is to take advantage of the domestic market. They're not there to, as we thought 8 or 9 years ago, put a plant there, get cheap labor, and ship back to the United States or to Western Europe. That's not happening. I mean, there's a little bit of that, but nothing like what we thought might happen. They're there for the Chinese market.
Because the domestic demand in China is just so great.
Phenomenal, yeah.
Are there any companies, Chinese-based companies, that you see as that your members see as competition in export markets, or maybe even people who are looking to acquire or build in other parts of the world?
Oh, I'm sure we will. There are companies that are showing signs of becoming truly global, getting their quality up to global standards, and we'll see more and more of that as time goes on. Just like the Japanese companies came here following their customers, we have about 400 Japanese suppliers here in North America, and we're going to see the same thing as Chinese OEMs come here. We'll start to see a number of Chinese suppliers. There's already some buying and taking place where they're buying technology and buying capability to accelerate the rate of becoming globally capable. Take Geely and what they've done with Volvo. It's very, very, from an OEM perspective, that's a major milestone.
That is a major milestone, no question about it.
Yeah, but their future plans are a little suspect in China with Volvo. They're selling, 23,000 Volvos, and their leader said we're going to sell 335,000 by 2015.
I'll tell you, that's a lot more possible, in my view, than what we were talking about earlier here in North America.
Yeah, well, it is possible, but good luck with that.
Yeah. Well, look at the growth, though. I mean, you're talking 50, 60% some
years. Oh, I know. It's staggering. It's unreal to look at.
But I think establishing that brand as a prestige brand is the difficulty there. I have no doubt they could churn them out. Mm-hmm. It's whether the Chinese people accept Volvo as like an Audi or a...
That's a good question. And I didn't realize that their sales were so low, 23,000 or so, you say? Yeah. That's nothing. That's amazing.
They will have to establish Volvo as being like Audi.
But isn't that also because Volvo was not built there, so what you have is a tremendous import tax duty, so it's much more competitive to buy a Buick that's domestically made and significantly lower in price.
We'll see if he can throw money at Volvo and make it become... Because Audi's gangbusters there now.
Yeah, number one in the luxury segment.
Yeah.
Neil, going back to that push model, has that changed the behavior of the big three, GM, Ford, and Chrysler? Because over the last decade and a half, they just took your members and they just crushed them, just pounded them for price cuts every single time. You know, it started with Ignacio Lopez when he came to town, and we saw an absolute decade and a half or two decades of your members getting murdered. And I'm just wondering if that's changed in the last year with the push model being gone.
Not sure you can attribute it to the push or pull model, but definitely there's been a significant change in relationships. I'm just very, very impressed with what I'm hearing. And, yeah, we're still suspect, and, you know, it takes mutual trust.
Show me. Respect. Just don't tell me.
Exactly.
Show me, right?
And we have our members saying, show me. But we had a town hall meeting with Dan Knott at Chrysler a couple weeks ago, and he announced his guiding principles, 8 principles of how they will work with suppliers.
And is it going back to the old Tom Stahl camp score approach, more like that?
No, that was a way of sharing the benefits of making improvements. But this was the principles of how we will work together. And, you know, being honest and announcing up front and doing this and doing that and basically how you and I will treat each other as buyer and sellers. And it requires mutual trust. You know, Dan says, I'm going to take the first step because I need to, but you know, you have to step with me eventually. You know, I can understand why you're going to hesitate, but eventually you're also going to have to trust and take that first step, and then we're going to make progress like you wouldn't believe. And I think at Ford, we're seeing similar improvements with their rating with suppliers. The relationship has improved significantly. They are, in fact, very, very close to where Nissan is, and there's a lot of people suspect that Ford will be number 3 after Honda and Toyota next year.
And you're
year.
Talking about John Henke, Planning Perspectives, the way he rates the or has suppliers rate the different purchasing departments. And the big 3 have always been below the top
the bottom
Japanese.
3, and the Japanese are way up here. And in fact, in 2005, the rankings, the difference between the best and the worst was 300 points difference on a scale of 0 to 500. This year, the difference between the best and the worst was 150 points. We've cut the difference in half. Now, part of that is because the best got a little worse. But
Toyota, Nissan, and Honda are coming down.
Yeah, but also because the domestic, the worst, are getting better, and some are getting better fast. So we're seeing.
Okay, you mentioned
together.
Ford, you mentioned Chrysler, you didn't mention General Motors.
Yeah, same thing. Bob Socia is very, very dedicated to.
And Bob Socia runs purchasing at GM.
At GM,
right?
Yeah, sorry. And we're seeing, again, there's the doubters, and there's still the problem of how do you get this down to the buyer level where the real relationship.
And has that changed? Because I've always said the guys at the top have always talked, you know, kumbaya, we love you, let's all be partners, early involvement. And when you get down to the buyer level, it's still, give me the cheapest price.
Yeah. They're working at it.
Is that still the model, though? Because, I mean, part of the problem has always seemed to be you can say beautiful things, but if your purchasing people are rewarded for getting the lowest price, suppliers are going to be squeezed. I mean, have they changed the compensation model for people?
The compensation model also includes relationship with suppliers.
Oh, that's so significant. That's and that's come important. About in the last year?
In the last year and a half, yeah. Hmm. And that is a major, major plus because they're getting measured also on how are you getting along with suppliers and what's the relationship and, you know, blah, blah, blah. So we're doing something really exciting that I got to let you know about.
Yeah.
Next week, Thursday, for the first time in the history of the automotive industry, we have 8 vehicle manufacturers getting together with a number of my members as suppliers, and we're going to talk about developing industry standard terms and conditions.
And what does that mean?
What that means is the purchase order terms and conditions under which we operate have always been very self-serving and one-sided. If you're the big automotive vehicle manufacturer, you have the right to everything, your intellectual property, warranty responsibility. If I tell you you're responsible, I'll hold back money. I can do anything I want because, you know, the value.
I'm the 800-pound gorilla.
That's right. And the value of an order for me keeps you alive, and therefore you'll do whatever I want to get the order. And what we're saying basically now is if buyers and sellers were equal, what would the language be? And we developed that 6-7 years ago at OESA. And what we've said now to the OEMs is, will you come, at least come to a meeting, and you're interested in better relations. There's nothing worse than negotiating these terms every time there's a purchase order because it affects relationships so dramatically. It creates such tension. And, you know, we want to work with our customer. We want to get the order, but we don't want to give up our intellectual property, which is our lifeblood. And this stuff just keeps people up at night. We're getting together and we're going to talk about can we develop, like we did with quality standards 20 years ago, can we find a way to work together and come up with common terms and conditions? Then we don't have to negotiate every time there's a PO. And that will just reduce tension dramatically, and it should improve collaboration, partnership, and everything. So it's the first, and it's a major milestone.
Eight OEMs. That's impressive.
Yep. Now, several of them have said, I'll come to the meeting. But I may not come to the second. Yeah,
but I'm bringing my hammer.
Yeah. You know, but the point is, they're coming, and it's up to us to be convincing enough to say this is worthwhile. And, you know, when we did that, when not we as OESA, but when the industry did that with quality standards in the 80s, everybody said, oh, no, I'm different, and quality is a differentiator, and I'm not going to, I'm not going to cooperate and work with Ford. Our system's better. Ford says, yeah, right, ours is better. And they ended up getting together. It took 5 years. But what happened is we have common quality standards but common forms, so you don't have a supplier that sells to every OEM filling out different forms for the same thing and creating all kinds of paperwork. So anyway, we're excited about it.
Yeah, I can imagine you'd be excited about that. Well, hey, I think it's time in the show to turn to rapid fire. Ben, let's bring up that graphic. We've got a comment from Tim here. He says, can Chrysler's brand go up market and be a luxury brand, considering that Fiat wants to bring in Alfa Romeo and that the Chrysler brand has been so down market for years fighting with Chevrolet and Ford? Can they go up market, Peter?
With a full-on push and full-on money, maybe in 8 years.
Mark, you see them?
No.
You don't?
They've got to become a competent mass market brand before they can think about anything else.
But Sergio doesn't think like that. He just thinks, we'll just do it. But
right.
It doesn't work that way.
Right.
Even if everything went well, I'll say 8 years. But, Mark, you're right. I don't see it happening.
Jim Haynes has a question for Neil here. Do you see growth in suppliers who are aiming to sell, let me rephrase this here. Do you see suppliers trying to reach out into the aftermarket to go to keep sales going when OEM sales are going slow?
Well, that's an interesting question because there have been many suppliers that are both in the original equipment and in the aftermarket, like Federal Moguls almost split 50-50. Dana bought a aftermarket company to be closer to 50-50 and Eklund and then sold it off. Again, so this has been a philosophy, like, should I be global? Should I be split between aftermarket and OE? I think it'll be a mixed bag, and it'll be individual companies who will make those decisions. There won't be a general trend that goes across the board.
It just goes in cycles, then.
We basically say core. Focus on your core competence, and that's when you get rid of your aftermarket if you're OE or vice versa. And then you go back to the philosophy of spreading it so that when OE sales are down, your aftermarket sales go up because people keep their vehicle longer and repair their vehicle more. But it's mixed.
Mike D. White asks, wouldn't more lives be saved with better driving instead of more fortified cars? Peter, what do you think?
Well, that's a fundamental premise. I mean, if we had the money in this country to educate our drivers properly, we'd be much better off.
Whole lot better off. You know, that goes back to that whole Ford Firestone Tire Explorer thing. I said at the time, there's no reason if you're going straight down the road and a tire blows out that you should go upside down and get killed. That's purely driver error. I don't blame the tire. I don't blame the vehicle. In that incident, it's like I blame the driver. And, we need better driver error.
But, you know, imagine the scale of something like that.
Salvador G. wants to know, is the new VW Jetta that's going to be sold in America the same as the European version?
No. I don't think it is it?
It's a really good question. I don't know. The America is by far the largest market in the world for the Jetta.
Is that right?
Yes, it is. It's weird.
I did not know that.
And weirdly enough, this is the only place in the world where the Jetta outsells the Golf.
Well, I bet you.
So, the Golf gets, you know, the A-game of the European engineers. So there's probably, I would think that there's not enough volume in Europe to make sense to engineer a different
version. One.
No, but I bet it has more content in it.
Oh, you could be right on that. Yeah.
Europe.
Absolutely. Okay. What's everyone's opinion on the new Chevy Cruze? I haven't driven it yet. So I was supposed to, and we had weather problems. I couldn't get on the trip, and
I was stuck in Washington, D.C. for an extra 7 hours because of those weather problems. Yeah, I was trying to get back from the trip to Detroit.
I spent a wonderful 6 hours in the airport trying to get out to the Chevy Cruze drive. So I can't say yet until I drive it. Everything sounds good.
Yeah, I think it's competent. Its design
is a snooze.
Is a snooze compared to the new Focus, but I'm sure engineering and technology-wise, it's very good. Delivers excellent fuel economy.
It's huge inside.
Yeah, it's very.
See, and that's going to work well in the American market. Yeah. Yeah. I think
you're right. Compared to the Focus, it fades into the wallpaper, and the Focus will be able to sell style and technology, and the Cruze will be able to make a pretty compelling argument in terms of virtually mid-size luggage and passenger space and remarkably good fuel economy. So it'll be real interesting to see how buyers sort those two out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Hey, let's bring in one of the phone calls, Ben. I see that we've got the calls are starting to pile up. Let's bring one in.
Hey, guys. Jonathan Brown out in Old Bend, New Jersey. I have a quick second question on the Fiat 500 distribution in the United States. Wasn't it Monday morning they said you have to have a separate dealership or separate service department, parts department, if you want to sell the Fiat 500? I don't know. That evening they came back and said we had a successful meeting. 165 people showed interest in selling the Fiat 500 in their existing dealerships. And if they want Alfa Romeo a year later, then they have to do a separate dealership and stuff. Do you think the dealers told Chrysler that they were insane and there was no way they were going to start up and build a dealership based on one vehicle? And then Fiat bosses backed up and said, okay, we'll let you have the Fiat. And then if you want the Alpha, that's when you have to create the satellite, or was this already pre-planned? I hope my question was clear. I apologize. Listen, thanks a lot. Great show. Your guests are fantastic, and as always, Peter, you're a wild man. Looking forward to hear what you have to say.
Thanks, Jonathan.
I would be willing to bet that the dealers backed them off of that.
I had a feeling that some stuff got lost in translation, too, that Chrysler said separate facility, and dealers understandably assumed the worst, and thought that meant a whole different place,
right.
Whereas Chrysler was saying it can't be sitting next to.
It's got to be a showroom within the showroom for the 500.
Yeah.
And I don't know what their plans are for Alpha.
And anybody who's got a separate building that they've used for used cars, if they'll turn that into a Fiat dealership, they go to the head of the list, I think. Oh. But you know, initially, they're not going to ask people to set up. And frankly, even when they get Alpha, I have a hard time seeing how you've got the volume to justify people asking people to buy new real estate and build a whole new physical plant.
I think Alpha's going to be an excruciatingly slow ramp up here. I mean, sure, when all the enthusiasts get done buying an Alpha, then what?
The key is that it's never made money in Europe, and that does not bode well. If they don't get their quality fixed, and that's, I think, the big thing that's held back sales in Europe, because the cars are drop-dead gorgeous. I mean, who wouldn't want to be seen in an Alpha? But clearly, the word of mouth has gotten around that they're good to look at, but don't buy one. So they've got to fix that problem in Europe before they can even think about getting successful in this market.
And they've got to come up with a convincing one that they're going to build at a Chrysler plant here. I mean, they say that the volume Alphas will be built at Chrysler plants here, and they'll be sort of mid-sized sport sedan, sport wagon. They've got to show us that they've got one of those.
I just think volume Alphas is an oxymoron.
Yeah.
If I was running the show, I'd say, look, we're going to keep bringing the 8C Competizione over here in coupe and in spider form, and that's all we're going to sell in the U.S. market. And if you guys can't figure out how to sell 500 of them, then
forget it. Right. J.D. Clough says, please ask Peter what he thinks of the new Sonata hybrid commercial. Is it good or bad in getting their message across?
I haven't seen it. I had a glimpse of it, but I haven't seen it enough to comment on it. So.
Okay. Fields Ferrier says, maybe you've all talked about this, but with Ford no longer moving the Kuga to Louisville, Kentucky, will it still be the next generation Escape? If so, will it be imported from Germany?
It will still be the next generation Escape. Louisville was always going to build the next generation Escape, and it will be the Kuga. The question was just whether the currencies meant that it made sense to build 80,000 more of them or so a year in Louisville and ship them back to Germany. And it looks like that's not going to make sense now. But it will still be built in the United States. And my understanding is that it's Louisville that's going to be the home of the new Escape, and it will be virtually identical to the Kuga.
And it's...
Does the UAW realize the opportunity it lets slip through its fingers here to be able to export 80,000 vehicles out of that plant to Europe?
Let's consider that. No.
Question, though. How much of it, and I have no idea what the answer to this is, how much of it is UAW inflexibility? How much of it is currencies moving? I mean, Volkswagen is spending $1 billion in order to ship fewer cars from Europe to America. I mean, did you know the currency futures just convince Ford it doesn't make sense to ship the Kuga back to Germany?
Well, I would say when you look at the debt level in this country, I think the dollar is going to be weak for a long time to come. And even though it fluctuates a little bit and it's climbed a little bit against the euro in the last month or so, I think the union should have done everything in its power to make sure that it, Louisville, was exporting 80,000 vehicles to Europe. Especially when Obama is trying to double the exports out of this country. I mean, you'd think that even the administration would call the union and say, hello, you'd think.
Well, the net of it is this vehicle is quite sensational looking.
The Kuga.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
it's cool.
In Escape form, it's going to be hot.
Okay, next call, Ben. Let's bring it in.
Hey, guys. This is Derek V. from Plainfield, Illinois. And just a quick question for Rapid Fire. Is Honda trying to get out of the automobile business? First, the redesign of the Acuras with the smiley face, then the Civic, and now the new Odyssey van. Have you seen it? Oh, I threw up in my mouth. So just what are your thoughts on that? And where are they going, or do they even know? Thanks. Bye-bye.
Well, Jen, I remember you told me you did not like the new Odyssey. This is about 6 months ago. But then subsequently you've driven it.
I've driven it. I drove it last week, as a matter of fact. And they've got this funny belt line that they call the lightning bolt.
Right.
And it's kind of clever because it drops the DLO, the glass, in the third row. So if you got little kids down there, it actually drops the belt line so that they can see out of the vehicle more. And again, we've seen this on another Honda, too, the Cross Tour. It looks a whole lot better in person than it does in photography. And I'm telling you, to me, the Odyssey, in that there's a silver shot that you can see front three-quarter on the side, it just does not look good, not good at all. So it's a van that's sensitive to whatever color it's painted in. It's something that does not shoot well. But I can tell you, the Odyssey does look better. Does it look great? No. No minivan looks great. None have yet, at least. But I think this guy's got a good point. We've talked about this before. Honda has lost its mojo.
Yeah.
Honda's a troubled automaker. But one thing I will say about the Odyssey is that the V6 gets better fuel economy than a four-cylinder Sienna. And that's a significant achievement, and that's something that you can sell minivans on. And frankly, it's the first Honda in years that has had an engineering achievement that seemed like it actually would make a difference to owners, to me. Because, I mean, I was with the caller on, you know, the ZDX. I don't know why that needs to exist. I drove a CRZ recently. It's less fun to drive and gets worse fuel efficiency than a 1999 Insight. What did they think they were achieving?
Yeah, well, you know, it's like we've talked about before. I've got all the respect in the world for Honda as a company, but, man, they need somebody to go in there and start knocking some heads together because the product just isn't up to snuff.
Yeah.
Not to Honda standards,
yeah.
No. I don't think. Ben, let's bring in another.
Hey, guys. This is Frank from Bridgeton, New Jersey. Great show, as always. John, I agree with your point about the oil and tying it to what we pay, both in dollars and treasure, to keep our oil flowing. I think we have to put it as a national security issue. I think the problem we have in this country is that we as Americans are naturally skeptical when government says, hey, I'm doing this for your own good. Because we know, no, you're not. You're doing it because it's in your interest and the people who support your campaign. However, I think if we had some real leadership in this country that actually could speak to the national security interest and get our patriotism going, we definitely could get off OPEC oil within a decade. I think we could probably even do it quicker than that, because when we put our minds to something in this country, we get it done. But thanks a lot, guys. Keep up the great work. And this is Frank from Bridgeton, New Jersey.
Thanks, Frank.
Yeah, thanks for the comment, Frank. Yeah. Here's another one that came in via email. Is the new VW plant going to share production with Audi, or does VW intend to undercut Audi of America? What do you think their intent is?
Not going to share. I'm sorry, Neil.
No, the official comment last week, I don't know how official it was, but Tom Loafman said there is no plans to have Audi production.
Plans unless Peter's right and they can't sell these things. Yes. Then they're definitely going to want to put another model in there. And
if they sort of cheapen it and dumb it down, as you summed up the Jetta, there's no way the cars out of there are going to be competing with Audi. I mean, they won't be competing with Honda.
Yeah.
Joseph writes in to say, with the news being hinted at that a Duramax diesel will go in the CTS, what are the chances that GM will admit to the hole in the Cadillac lineup left by the death of the North Star? My understanding is it was shelved only because pre-bankruptcy, GM could not afford to retool the Tonawanda plant in New York. Duramax couldn't fit in a CTS.
No, well, let's not forget that magnificent turbo diesel engine that GM had ready to go.
V6, wasn't it?
I think 8.
No, it was a V8.
I think it was an 8, 4 liters or 4.
Yeah,
five.
Magnificent engine, and because of the bankruptcy, they shelved it. I have to believe, and that was designed for passenger.
Oh, that's what must be that he's referring to, not the big Duramax truck engine.
That was designed to be a Cadillac passenger car.
Yeah, I have to believe that they're going to dust that off.
Yeah.
I mean, and bring it out.
Because that, you know, that won some awards, advanced design technology. It was supposed to be the most advanced diesel engine in the world, even more so than Audi, Volkswagen.
Plus, with the fuel economy standards, 35.5 miles per gallon by 2016, they got it.
Yeah.
Do some of this stuff.
So
Cadillac needs that engine to be a relevant player in Europe, and they really want to be relevant in Europe.
So I imagine we're going to hear that pretty soon.
Cool.
Rumors of that coming back online.
Ben, we got more phone calls. Let's bring one in.
Yes, this is Jim Dollinger calling the Buick Man, and I'd like to know why you think GM is in such a hurry to float an IPO when they still have accounting irregularities and material weaknesses in the financial statements. This does not inspire investor confidence. These things should be straightened out before we try to sell stock to the public. Do you agree?
That's our friend Buick Man.
Who writes to me all the time. Hi, Jim. I have to say, I tend to agree. I think that GM desperately wants to shut people up when they say Government Motors. And you know, I think that, you know, they probably are rushing it a little bit. You know, I mean, there's no way.
But don't you think they're under pressure from the White House?
Possibly. Yeah, I don't know about that, but I know.
What do you hear, Neil?
Yeah, they desperately want to get rid of
government motors.
And the thing that you keep hearing is that that's 10 to 20% increase in market share if we can get rid of that. That's holding people back from buying.
That much?
10
wow.
to 20, you know, if they're 17% market share.
Sure.
So you're talking 1.7 to 3.4%.
Right, but that's a lot.
Yeah, and that's some of the stuff I've heard, and there's some people really believe
that. But Dollinger raises a really good point. All the financials of GM bragging of how they've put two profitable quarters together, all the fine print says these are not to generally accepted accounting principles. And so they're saying whatever they want, you know,
and
potentially.
They created $30 billion of book value by saying that they had goodwill. You know, it was just an accounting, you know, trick to create a good-looking balance sheet.
You know, my guess is that probably the numbers are directionally correct and they probably are making money and all that. But if I'm a big pension fund or institutional investor, am I going to pour billions into this company when it says, hey, guess what? These numbers are funny, and no no accountant would ever approve this kind of way of doing things. So.
I think you're going to invest into a company, though, that has products like the CTS and other products that are coming out that are just fantastic. They have done a great job in product lineup with new stuff coming out, as you're all aware of, and I would invest in a company like that. When you look at the book value of what's left, I mean, they've got their books under control better than they ever had, and this is a time when it's an opportunity that isn't going to come again very often.
No, that's right. I mean, somebody taught me a long time ago, you can make money investing in the auto industry. Mm-hmm. And when they say, those guys are idiots and they don't know what they're doing, that's when you buy the stock. And when they go, oh, my God, look how much they've learned, they've turned it around, that's when you sell. Yep. So,
and if they are feeling pressured to sell early before they could get the best possible price, that would make this initial sale the time to, you know, jump in and buy and figure it's going to go up. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not allowed to, you know, invest in anything that I cover, any company that I cover.
Invest so in quick covering.
There we go.
We're getting close to the top of the hour, but we've got some more phone calls coming in. Ben, let's bring them in.
Jim Campbell calling from Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Just a quick little question for your guest. With SEMA just around the corner, how are you finding with the aftermarket suppliers and those kinds of things? Is that business still growing? Or are we looking at just maybe having a business where it's just going to be upgrading your wheels and tires with spinner hubcaps and those kinds of things? Great show. Talk to you later.
I'm not an expert on the aftermarket. I spent 48 years in this industry focused on OE. So I'm really not sure what you were asking.
SEMA's the big aftermarket show.
Oh, the SEMA show. Okay. Yeah. I'm sorry. I didn't hear SEMA. I thought you were talking about a product. Yes. Well, SEMA's struggling a little bit in the last couple of years, but they've done a tremendous job of bringing the OEMs in with the aftermarket products and working together to try to produce add-ons that really create excitement. And now the OEMs are very much want to be a part of that profitability and seeing where they can have dealer-installed options and so forth, where they have a little bit of control over that part of the market.
SEMA grew too quickly, too big, and they had, when the crash came, they got hurt.
Well, they had a 20% adjustment in their workforce, and significant.
The other thing, too, is SEMA really hitched its wagon to the tuner market, yeah. And that thing just sort of evaporated.
Yeah, it fast and furiously disappeared.
Ben, let's keep them rolling.
Hey, guys, great show. Jonathan Brown out in Old Japan, New Jersey. Just a quick question. How many years till the Chinese government nationalizes the automobile industry and kicks GM and all the other foreigners who are, quote, partners in the Chinese industry, automotive industry, out on their butt? And that's my question.
Well, they wouldn't throw them out. They would just nationalize them.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what he's saying. You know?
Yeah, that could happen. Yeah.
Except that they're becoming so much, they're so dependent on trade that they do with the rest of the world that they can't really build a new Great Wall of China. I mean, you know, they're pretty inextricably, you know, intertwined with the rest of the world at this point.
No, they don't. I mean, they haven't gotten that memo yet with the currency.
I don't know. There's some real dangerous signs, and hopefully the Chinese will get it straightened out. But for example, there's big subsidies for quote unquote green cars, not if they're imported. Okay. In fact, there's even uncertainty as to whether it applies if you're a foreign maker in China. That still has to be resolved.
We've been very open in this country with $1.4 billion to Nissan for their electric vehicle program.
You know, right. That would never happen in China.
That would never happen in China.
And I think everybody should say in the back of keep in the back of their minds, are these guys just letting us teach them how to do everything and then one day say, thank you very much, now you're no longer invited to be here? I think that's a danger. I'm not sure that that's going to happen, but I think it's something that you got to be aware of.
Yeah, but I think Mark's point, though, they're so dependent for continued growth on trade globally that if they upset their global trading partners to that kind of a degree, because we would have no option but to retaliate as a country. I mean, my God.
And Germany, I mean, every other industrialized nation has got manufacturing in China.
course, they are a bigger market than North America and Europe and South America, and I think about all the rest of us put together.
Yep. Yeah.
So, Ben, we got a few more. Let's bring them in.
Hey, John, this is Jeff Bankston. I had a question in regard to Eco Motors. And when are we going to see the first four-cylinder engine in a vehicle domestically? And also, will it be produced down in Monroe, Michigan? Other part of the question is transonic combustion. This fuel atomizer, can it be used on existing engines to increase fuel economy, or is it going to just be used on new engines? And why don't they combine both transonic and eco into the same system? And Jeff Bankston, thank you very much.
Yeah, a lot of ifs that I don't think we have the answers to. You know, when we had the guys from Eco Motors here, what they said is we will see a driving prototype next year. We'll be able to drive the car or drive the engine in a car next year. So then to say, you know, when could it be ready for production? I'm guessing 3 to 5 years would be blindingly fast for something like that to happen in this industry. Who knows? Will it be made in Monroe, Michigan? More likely to be made in China is my figure in on it. And the idea of combining this transonic combustion, and if you don't know what we're talking about, just get online and Google it. You'll learn about it. Remember, what was the guy's name that we had here, Peter? What was Peter's name? Hofbauer? When we asked him about the ignition and intake, and he said, he wasn't talking about that. So it would not surprise me if the transonic injection system is going to go on the Eco Motors engine. And then last point, will it go on existing engines? You bet. That's why they're so excited about it. Looks like you can just sort of bolt this on to an engine and get a dramatic increase in fuel economy.
Is that relatively near term, do you think?
Again, I don't know. We need to get...
3 to 5 years.
Is that it? Okay.
I'm just...
Everything's three to five years.
Everything's 3 to 5 years.
It's like a hydrogen. 20 years.
Yeah. Right. And again, the only reason that we're interested in Eco Motors or transonic combustion is when you see, in the case of transonic, people like Bob Lutz on the board, Don Runkle on the board, and the case of Eco Motors, Don Runkle again, John Coletti. It's like these are known entities. We know these people. We trust these people. Been there, done that. They're not just some fly-by-nights, and that's why we're so interested in those two companies. And we've got one more call that we'll take, Ben.
Yeah, John, this is Bert from San Diego. I don't think if energy issue. I still think that the better solution is alternative energy sources. And we have a surplus of ethanol, and with all these millions of vehicles that can use E85, it's, you know, why not use them? I mean, the government can mandate that E85 is more readily available. We have millions of vehicles that can use it. We have alternative ways, non-food-based ways of creating it, which will create millions of jobs in different companies for multiple suppliers. We already have an infrastructure that can use it with millions of cars that are capable of burning it. We'll put millions of people to work so they will actually be able to buy new vehicles and fuel them. There can be the infrastructure exists. We can become a lot more energy independent quite a bit faster without the possible need to go protect supplies of EV-based elements like lithium and so on, which will create other national security issues. And it'll create millions of jobs for the technology of the engines and everything else that's associated with them. And you boost the economy, you boost the jobs, and I just think it'll be a better solution than other ways.
Yeah, well, Bert, amen, brother. I'm totally with you on that one. I've always said that rather than pass all these laws that say engines have to be more efficient and cars have to be more efficient, I mean, if the problem is that we have problems importing fuel and we're putting all this carbon in the air, the answer is clear. Change the stupid fuel. And I totally agree with you on what you're saying about ethanol. The big fight, though, is this. There's millions of E85 vehicles on the road today. try to find an E85 gas station. Man, it's hard to find them. Why? Because the gas station owner, it's like $10,000 a pump for them to put it in there. It's a royal pain in the ass for them. So now the big argument, the big fight, and it's going on this week as we speak in Washington, is the EPA wants to raise the amount of ethanol that we put in gasoline from the current E10 to E15. And there's a big fight over this whole thing. But the idea is if you have E15 in everything, then you don't need the E85 vehicles, and then you don't need the E85 pumps. You can just put it in everything. And you're right, we have a surplus of ethanol in this country right now. I believe the EPA will go to E15, but there's a big fight about it, and almost all the car companies are opposed to it, which I don't get.
Fine. Yeah, part of the reason, I think, is that it's corrosive. So there's real problems with the mechanical.
The Renewable Fuels Association just came out with a study, very in-depth study done by Ricardo. Again, these are not fly-by-night operations. And Ricardo said, it's not an issue. Even in older cars, we can go to E15. And I've been arguing all along, you know, in Brazil, it's E22, and they went there 10 years ago, and it's a non-issue.
And GM and Ford and Volkswagen and everybody else knows how to sell engines, build and sell engines that run on that because they're all huge in Brazil.
See, I believe the big three and automakers are against it because they get massive CAFE credits for every flex fuel E85 vehicle that they make. Now, if you're going to put E15 in everything, well, we no longer need E85 vehicles. You lose all those CAFE credits. I personally believe that's why they're opposed to it. It doesn't make any other sense when they're selling engines like this in Brazil every single day and it's a non-issue. There. Now I'll step down from my soapbox. And actually, we should all step down. We're at the top of the hour here. And good time to wrap this all up. But Neil DeCoker, thanks so much for coming in and sharing your thoughts and what OESA is doing and what your members and the supplier community are up to.
Thanks for inviting me, John. It was a pleasure.
Cool. That's great. Mark Feeling, great having you here.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
And Peter, the auto extremist, great having you here as well.
Thanks, John.
Next week, we're going to have Chris Pruse. He's the CEO of OnStar, who's going to be coming in here. I really look forward to that. OnStar is trying to reinvent itself, do a whole lot more technologically, and we'll have to get the first-hand poop on what they're doing and get that from Chris. Remember, you can always friend us at Facebook, facebook.com/OutOfLineDetroit. Follow us at Twitter, twitter.com/OutOfLine. Can get Peter's great rants and raves and all his insights at autoextremist.com. You can follow him at twitter.com/autoextremist. You can find all Mark Phelan stuff at freep.com, F-R-E-E-P. That's sort of the shortened thing for the Detroit Free Press, but freep.com. And you do all kinds of vehicle reviews and
vehicle
what else?
Reviews, columns. I've got this Sunday's column is about Jonathan Browning, the new head of Volkswagen, and the challenges that he faces that we were talking about earlier.
Cool.
So news, vehicles, a little bit of everything.
That's great. And there's got to be an OESA.org or something like
that's
that?
That's it.
Okay.
That's it.
That's great. So anybody who wants to know more about the supplier industry can find some things, or do you have to be a member to really get
no,
on there?
No. Anyone can get on the website and find out anything that we have online.
Good deal. Remember, folks, you can always get all our programs via Stitcher on your smartphone or BlackBerry. And thanks for being in. We'll see you all next week.
Visit our website, outoflinedetroit.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday nights at 7 p.m. Eastern, get your daily automotive news fix with Out of Line Daily, and in-depth analysis and interviews with Out of Line Detroit. That's all there, and much more, at outoflinedetroit.tv.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone. Passion for excellence.